This audio recording is protected under U.S. copyright laws. It is produced by Nichols Patrick CPE and provided by your state society of CPAs for your personal non-commercial use. Further reproduction, distribution, or commercial use of this recording without written permission from Nichols Patrick is prohibited. Requests for permission to reproduce this material should be addressed to Nichols Patrick CPE, Suite A, 973 West Liberty Street, Hubbard, Ohio, 44425. Welcome to the weekly tax update for February 10th, 2014. As usual, it was an interesting week with a wide variety of items. Let's quickly review the list for this week's content. We begin with Fact Sheet 2014-4, a fact sheet which outlines the eligibility for the Earned Income Tax Credit. Then we go to Internal Legal Memorandum 2014-05-014, in which the IRS addresses the capitalization of image enhancement payments from the standpoint of the company paying the payments, not from the company receiving the payments. Then Letter Ruling 2014-05-008, in which the IRS addresses an individual's failure to attach a copy of his 83B election to his individual income tax return, even though he filed a copy of the election with the IRS office where he files his tax return. The question is that substantial compliance, and is the 83B election valid? And the IRS answers that question in the letter ruling. Then I thought you might be interested in the Schedule UTP filing statistics for 2010, 2011, and 2012, just to discuss how that program is working for the Internal Revenue Service and for taxpayers. Next, we're going to talk a little bit about Revenue Procedure 2014-20, which provides a safe harbor under which the Internal Revenue Service will treat indebtedness secured by a single-member disregarded entity holding real property as indebtedness secured by the real property itself under Code Section 108C3A, which is the qualified real property business indebtedness exclusion from recognizing income from forgiveness of debt. Then a decision of the Sixth Circuit, Dr. Trip Darji, had some odd notions about what should be deductible from the repayment of the money that he borrowed to get through medical school. You'll get a kick out of this one. Of course, doctors' theories about what's deductible are always interesting. Then we have Internal Legal Memorandum 2014-06-001, in which the IRS addresses the question of whether a taxpayer's federal income tax deduction for the excise tax on special fuels must be reduced by the amount of the fuel tax credit. In that guidance, the IRS analogizes with the state income tax credits, which result in a reduction of the taxpayer's state income tax liability and reduce the federal tax deduction for state income taxes. So the IRS takes a similar position with regard to the fuel tax credits. And then to close out the program, we have another physician with some odd notions about what should be deductible in her tax return and where it should be deducted. It's Elizabeth A. Vitarbo, a TC Summary Opinion, 2014-11. So that's a lot to talk about. As they say, stay tuned. Let's start with Fact Sheet 2014-4. As part of its campaign to promote the availability of the Earned Income Tax Credit, the IRS released this four-page fact sheet outlining the eligibility rules, the credit limits for the 2013 tax year, online tools for determining eligibility, and common errors in claiming the credit. I read the four-page document, and it occurred to me this would be extremely useful for practitioners. There's a clear explanation of all the rules, all the limitations, and if you are training preparers, or if you have preparers who don't deal with the Earned Income Tax Credit on a regular basis, this is an ideal tool to prepare them and to equip them to deal with questions of eligibility, which are important because if you claim the credit for someone who's not eligible, that comes back on the practitioner now. Next, Internal Legal Memorandum 2014-05-014, in which the IRS concludes that construction support payments made by a taxpayer to retailers that distribute the taxpayer's products are not required to be capitalized by the taxpayer under Regulation Section 1.263, print little a-4. The taxpayer makes construction support payments to retailers to enable them to renovate their retail facility to incorporate 7 critical image elements. The construction support payments, according to the Internal Revenue Service, create an intangible right to require retailers to conform to facility design concepts. The IRS looked to Regulation Section 1.263, print little a-4, which provides rules for applying Section 263 to amounts paid to acquire or create intangibles. Specifically, the IRS believes the construction support payments do not create or enhance a separate and distinct intangible under Regulation Section 1.263A-4B3 because the rights have no value apart from promoting its products. Further, the IRS said the payments don't create a financial interest under Regulation Section 1.263A-4D2. They don't create a contract right under 1.263A-4D6, nor are they an improvement to real property, and no other category of expenditure was relevant. As I read this, it occurred to me that the real question in my practice would be, what about the tax treatment by the retailer? The IRS's historic position is that cash payments to a taxpayer for the purpose of image enhancement should be included in income, and if you want to read a little more about that, get publication 3106, which addresses image enhancement payments to gasoline stations by petroleum marketers. And there really is no other clear guidance. That's the best that I can offer you on that particular topic. If you have a client that is receiving image enhancement payments, go to publication 3106 and get the IRS's official take on the recipient's side of this transaction. Next, letter ruling 2014-05-008, the IRS rules that an individual Section 83B election related to the purchase of restricted stock is in effect because the requirements for a valid election were fulfilled and failure to submit a copy of the election with a tax return did not affect its validity. Here, let's just briefly review the facts. The IRS recites the facts this way. Your tax preparer assisted you with filing the election. You timely filed the election by mailing a statement to the Internal Revenue Service office with which you file your tax returns. The statement met the content requirements of Section 1.83-2E of the Income Tax Regulations. You provided a copy of the statement to your employer. You provided a copy. Your tax preparer failed to attach a copy of the election to your tax return. As a result, a copy was not submitted with your tax return, and subsequent tax returns, however, have all been filed in a manner consistent with having made a valid election, as well as the year in which you made the election. The IRS then goes into an explanation of how Section 83 works, concluding, based on your representations, and after consideration of the provisions of 83B of the Code and the regs, we have determined that you fulfill the requirements for a valid election under Section 83B, when your statement was mailed to the Internal Revenue Service office. Failure to submit a copy of the statement with your tax return did not affect the validity of the election. However, the IRS now asks the taxpayer to forward a copy of the statement to the IRS office where it should have been filed, and the taxpayer gets a favorable ruling. Next up, the Schedule UTP filing statistics. Beginning with tax year 2010, Schedule UTP tax return filers filed 2,143 Schedules UTP in 2011, 2,190, but in 2012 that number had dropped to 1,743. 77% of the issues were repeat issues in 2011, and that had dropped to 55% in 2012. 55% of UTP filers are publicly traded, and that number has been pretty constant. The total uncertain tax positions reported began at 4,882 in 2010, went up to 5,980 in 2011, dropped to 4,166 in 2012. The number of uncertain tax positions reported as carrying over from the prior year were 1,178 in 2011, 1,269 in 2012. The percent of UTP filers that reported only one uncertain position dropped from 48% in 2010 to 42% in 2012. The most commonly reported uncertain tax position, running at about 22-23% for all years, is positions regarding the research credit. Next up at running at about 20% would be transfer pricing, and then running at from 7% to 4% issues relating to capitalization. In any event, it would appear that the Schedule UTP is not as significant a factor in corporate tax compliance as some may have thought. Next, we have Revenue Procedure 2014-20 that provides a safe harbor under which the IRS will treat indebtedness that is secured by a single member disregarded entity holding real property as indebtedness secured by real property for the purposes of Code Section 108C3A, which is the qualified real property business indebtedness exclusion from the requirement to recognize income from forgiveness of indebtedness. In order to be treated as qualified real property business indebtedness, the indebtedness must be incurred by the taxpayer in connection with real property used in a trade or business and must be secured by that real property. The taxpayer must make an election to treat the indebtedness as qualified real property business indebtedness. Sometimes, real property is held by the taxpayer's wholly owned entity, that is, a disregarded entity for federal tax purposes. In those cases, the debt may be secured by the taxpayer's ownership interest in the disregarded entity holding the real property. This guidance, Revenue Procedure 2014-20, provides a safe harbor, a five-part test, which, if met, the IRS says will enable it to treat the debt as secured by real property for purposes of the Section 108C3A exception. The safe harbor requires that the borrower, the taxpayer, or its wholly owned disregarded entity must have incurred the indebtedness, and must own 100% of the ownership interest in a separate disregarded entity owning real property. The borrower must give the lender a first priority security interest in the borrower's ownership interest in the property. At least 90% of the fair market value of the total assets directly owned by the property owner must be real property used in a trade or business. In other words, the owner of the real property has got to be pretty close to insolvent. If 90% of the fair market value of all my assets is represented by qualified real property business property, then I don't have many other assets left. Any other assets held by the property owner must be incidental to the property owner's acquisition, ownership, and operation of the real property. And finally, the safe harbor requires that upon default and foreclosure, the lender must replace the borrower as the sole member of the property owner, the single member entity that actually owns the property. Again, that's Revenue Procedure 2014-20. This really has become a big deal as we went through the Great Recession and we had real property owned by single member LLCs where the business went under, and the question really was whether or not the relief from debt in that circumstance could be excluded from the borrower's taxable income. Revenue Procedure 2014-20 is effective for elections regarding discharge debt after February 4th, 2014, so it's no help for those repossessions in 2009, 10, 11, 12, and 13, unfortunately. Next, we have the strange case of Tripp Darji, T-R-I-P-P-D-A-R-G-I-E, a decision of the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals granting the government summary judgment on a physician's claim that he was entitled to a business expense deduction for the repayment of funds he received from a medical center to cover his education costs. Such a repayment is a non-deductible personal expense. In order to get through medical school, and Dr. Darji agreed that after graduation and completion of his residency, he would either repay the grant for his education by working as a doctor in an underserved community or by repaying twice the amount of his conditional award payments. Now, he got $73,000 while he was going through medical school. He decided after he graduated that he would not work in a medically underserved area, and he repaid a total $121,440. Now he asserts that the amount he repaid was a damages payment for breaching the agreement to work in a medically underserved area, so he argues the payment was an ordinary and necessary business expense, which should be deductible under Code Section 162, because by paying it, it enabled him to pursue his for-profit medical practice in a different area. The government, however, contends that the payment of the $121,000 does not qualify as a deduction because it's essentially educational expenses that allow the doctor to meet the minimum requirements for practicing medicine. Such expenditure, of course, would be personal. The court reasoned that to determine whether an expense is a non-deductible personal expense or a deductible business expense, it must look to the origin and character of the claim with respect to which the expense was incurred, rather than its potential consequences upon the fortunes of the taxpayer. And that's, by the way, is a quote from United States versus Gilmore, a Supreme Court decision back in 1963. So it is the circumstances under which Dr. Darji received the money which determine its business or personal characterization, not the circumstances under which he repaid it. And the circumstances under which he received it were that the money was educational, an educational expense, and it will never be deductible by Dr. Darji, and the government gets summary judgment. Next, Internal Legal Memorandum 2014-06-001, in which the IRS determines that a taxpayer's allowable federal income tax deduction for the Section 4041 excise tax on special fuels and the Section 4081 excise tax on petroleum products must be reduced by any amount of fuel tax credit allowed under Section 6426A. According to the IRS, when a credit is applied to an otherwise deductible liability, the deduction must be reduced by the amount of the credit. In an analogous situation, the IRS reminds us, it has consistently treated refundable state income tax credits as resulting in a reduction in the taxpayer's state income tax liability to the extent of the liability, leading to a reduced federal deduction for state income taxes. The allowable credit in this case is not to be treated as an item excluded from income that is used to satisfy an excise tax liability, but rather it must reduce the deduction for the excise tax. Finally this week, the strange case of Elizabeth A. Viterbo and her 2008 Form 1040. The doctor is a licensed and practicing neurosurgeon. In 2004, following completion of her residency, she entered into a physician recruitment agreement with Wilson Medical Center in Wilson, North Carolina. The terms of that agreement included she would be guaranteed a minimum amount of net income, she would be reimbursed up to a certain amount for moving expenses, the medical center would pay her student loan debt up to a certain amount, and further provided that she would be obligated to repay any amounts she received pursuant to the agreement if she failed to fulfill her obligations. At the time she entered into the agreement, she signed 3 promissory notes evidencing her debts for payments she received or would receive. According to the terms of the agreement, the debts evidenced by the notes would be forgiven ratably over time if the doctor fulfilled her obligations under the agreement. From the beginning, it appears that the doctor considered the amounts she received under the agreement as loans, and nothing in the record suggests that she treated them otherwise for federal income tax purposes during any of the years those payments were received. She decided to conduct her medical practice as a corporation, so she incorporated Wilson Neurological Associates in 2004, and she was an employee. She was the sole shareholder of Wilson Neurological Associates and its only employee, and considered that her obligations under her agreement with Wilson Medical Center could be satisfied as an employee of Wilson Neurological Associates, which apparently is what she did in the way she filed her tax returns. The compensation she received from 2004 through 2006 was reported on a Form W-2. Wilson Neurological Associates was dissolved in 2007. Beginning in 2006 and continuing to 2008, which is the year under examination, the doctor practiced as an employee of an educational institution. So from all the records, it would appear that for federal income tax purposes, her earnings as a neurosurgeon have consistently been accounted for as wages. There's nothing in the record that suggests for any year before 2008 she accounted for income earned and expenses paid or incurred on a Schedule C. However, a Schedule C shows up for the first time in her 2008 return, and the physician attempts to deduct legal fees, rent of property, and other expenditures on a Schedule C, and the court concludes that since she never worked as an independent physician. She never was independently engaged in the trade or business of practicing medicine. She was always an employee. The only place she could deduct those expenses was not on Schedule C, but was on Schedule A as an employee. And that's where the expenses went. Now, the problem, of course, is that the deducting expenses on Schedule A gives you no help with regard to your alternative minimum tax problems, if you have those. And, of course, then you've got the 2% limitation. So the doctor basically lost. And that's it. That's a wrap for this week. Again, thank you for joining us. And as always, our admonition, stay safe.